Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Deva Jayapal. Jayapal built a successful career in Wall Street, covering high-profile roles, and now works as an independent investment advisor. Jayapal took sannyas in 1977 and never left Osho. I'm so happy to have Jayapal on the show, and I hope you enjoy it. Jayapal, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm swell.
As a starter, tell us a bit about you and your story before meeting Osho.
I was brought up in a family of, my father was an artist, so it was a very avant-garde type of family, and they were open to pretty expansive new ideas. Freudianism in those days was very big. And so I was brought up with an orientation, a very non-religious orientation, an idea that God and nature were one. That was my parents, as dysfunctional a family as it was, that was something that they did imbue in me. So I was working in Wall Street for many years, and I was living a sort of double life because at the same time I was involved in the human consciousness movement in New York City, ranging from S to Arica, the whole Janovian primal scream period was going on in the 70s, in the early 70s, and I was really involved in that to a great extent. And I thrived on it. And at some point in time, having done all of these kind of alternative therapeutic processes and psychological things, and it started to feel kind of flat to me. And somebody said, well, why don't you try some of these Eastern mystical religions, which I thought was absurd. I've seen the Hare Krishnas in their orange robes, and it wasn't something that interested me. But just for the heck of it, I went down to the I bought 5 books, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism by Trungpa Rinpoche, Be Here Now, of course, by Ram Dass, a book by Suzuki. Anyway, one of the books was Meditation, the Art of Ecstasy, and I think that was maybe the second or third that I read. And I read the first page, and I was blown away. I was really blown away because he was talking about the non-duality of existence, and it's just something that I always knew but never was in a mindset to articulate it or even knew who I could talk to about stuff like that. But I always knew that there was no such a thing as this or that. It was all part of this whole. So anyway, I got blown away by just reading that first page, and I went to the Osho Center in Manhattan in New York and to meditate, which I had no idea what that really meant. And turned out that meditation there was dynamic meditation. I've never experienced, and I couldn't imagine what that was. And it was wild. It was fantastic. It was very juicy. I got really excited. I went to the center. I said, I'm going to go to India. If I went to Pune, I was still very much involved in Wall Street, making a lot of money. And I knew that my time of leaving was near, but it was wild. It was really wild. That was back in 77. And during the group, I sat around thinking, should I take sannyas? Should I not take sannyas? And I was looking at this book, I Am the Gate. My mind was back and forth. And at some point, I said, the hell with it. I'm just going to jump for it. And that was it. And that was in August of 77, before I went in to take sannyas, before I went into the little auditorium, take sannyas. Vivek said, you know, Stephen Sherman, which was my name or is my name, from now on, you're never going to be the same. And I thought, what are you, crazy? What's wrong? Then I went in and he said, you know, your name is Deva Jayapal. He says, Deva means divine and Jayapal means king. And in that instant, I thought, I fooled him. Then he said, nah, but you're just a beggar now. You have the possibility of becoming a king. And then, and it was true. After that, my life really was never the same. And so took sannyas. I came back to New York, gave them, Osho actually said to me, he said, you go back He said, there are good people there, and you come back, say goodbye there and come back forever. And I went back and gave notice, gave a year's notice, but only I only stayed 6 months, and people were beautiful. I was in this very white shoe investment banking firm, and I was always wearing orange suits. I had custom-made orange suits with my mala, and, you know, and they used to call me their sunshine partner. So that was really fun, being in the middle of this dark-suited world in my orange, and got a lot of, you know, magazines were coming up and writing articles about it, and it got some publicity, and it got Osho some publicity as well. So then I went back to Pune, and basically for the next 7 years, I was in Pune and then at the ranch in Oregon.
I understand that during the critical time of Osho moving from India to Oregon, you were involved in the difficult task to find land for the new commune. In your personal view, why Osho left India and moved to the U.S.?
He saw just vast possibilities in the United States. You know, the whole New Age revolution was kind of going on in the 70s, and there was a lot of openness to new ideas. And I feel as if he was not really, as you know, that well received in India in a general sense. And I think that he really saw some huge potential in the United States. And it was if he had been allowed to stay, I think it would have been incredible. But he wasn't. A very, very special time. I mean, actually, Osho coming to my home.
After leaving Pune and before settling in Oregon, Osho spent some time in a castle in New Jersey near your hometown, New York, and you were there. Can you tell us a little bit more about life in the castle? What was happening there?
Mostly I can tell you what was happening for me, because everybody had their own jobs. I mean, there was a real air of incredible expectancy. It was very exciting. One of my jobs was to bring up these limousines for him to look at, because he wanted a new limousine to replace the one he left behind in India. And this was quite hilarious, because I'd have to tell these limousine companies to tell the driver he could not put any aftershave lotion on, he couldn't smoke. And these limousines would come up and Osho would walk out like the little king, you know, and these drivers were just like, their faces would fall. But people were preparing for his arrival, covering up this beautiful woodwork with white paint, putting in a little elevator so he could elevate himself up a set of stairs. With perspective, it's very different, but at the time, it was like beyond incredible, you know. And there were, what, maybe 40 people there. And one of my jobs was I did these shopping trips for Osho in New York, because I knew my way around New York. So would go down there and buy. I could go into a lot of detail. A lot of funny things happened, Swaram. A lot of funny things happened. It was a joy, and it was wild, and just when he arrived, it was beautiful. I mean, just to have a little satsang on the lawn with him when he came. And then life carried on, and we all had our chores. I'd do the shopping. I'd come back with hats for him to try on, or sunglasses was another one of his favorites. Bring back 8 or 9 pairs of sunglasses from all over Fifth Avenue, and he would pick out the ones that really appealed to him.
You used to go to New York and buy expensive stuff for Osho, glasses and Rolex. So what's your view on the relationship between money and Osho?
I didn't mention the Rolexes, but anyway.
Well, money, I know about that. I know Osho loves Rolexes.
Right. No. The question was, what is the relationship that I see between Osho and money?
Yes.
I thought a lot of the whole financial thing was many levels to it. One of them was basically satirizing the wealth and the materialism of the West. And even in India, there was a lot of that kind of material, wanting the biggest gold this and the biggest gold that. And I think that the idea that in order to be meditative or have a spiritual life, you were aided in some way by an impoverished state. And Osho was taking a very different perspective on this, which makes an awful lot of sense to me. When you don't have enough to eat and your kid doesn't have a school to go to, The last thing in the world you want to do is meditate. But when you have a certain amount of affluence and comfort, I think then, you know, it was this case for me, then it opened up a space where I could allow myself the luxury of meditation without feeling like I'm going to go hungry. So he was, of course, thumbing his nose at the traditional sannyasin of India historically, which was very ascetic.
That makes lots of sense. Osho brought so much revolution in the spiritual world, which is one of the most conservative, ancient type of establishment, if you like. And he broke also this association between being spiritual means being poor. What you're saying, if I understand correctly, that he was playing with this idea of spending money to show that the material level cannot be neglected, should not be neglected, and it's very much part of our life.
Yes, and also the whole sexual thing was also, I mean, there were very few spiritual teachers that I knew of who were really embraced sexuality and embraced sexual energy as he did.
Okay, great. So can you share with us some intimate time you spent with Osho?
Yeah, I don't even have to think about it because I always have one moment for some reason that I really treasured with him, and that was... We were doing these small satsangs where he would talk to a small group of people. Sometimes after it was over, sannyasins and people would line up along a path out of the little auditorium, and he would, and the music would be playing, and he'd come out. He'd be, you know, doing what he does with his arms up in the air. And just a moment happened where he and I made eye contact, and we started dancing together. And we started dancing and dancing and dancing together. And I was just gone, just lost in his face, his being, you know. It was just gorgeous. And I felt really no separation from him at that, in that moment, because that's hard to do. I often felt separation for years. I mean, that he was there and I was here, and that we weren't really breathing the same truth. And so that was really very, very special. And it always stands out for me as when he talks about saying, oh, you are my friends. He was my friend then. It wasn't like he was my guru or my teacher. We just melting. Beautiful.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. I also wanted to talk to you about Wild Wild Country, because you are from New York and now you are back living in the USA, in California. I understand that Wild Wild Country is a big thing, especially in the USA. Worldwide, lots of people are watching it, even in Singapore. There are colleagues of my beloved of Chetna who works in the banking industry, by the way. So she works in investment banking. And some of her colleagues told her about this Wild Wild Country without even knowing that she's a sannyasin.
Yeah.
So it's really spreading like fire, but I think in the USA even more than other countries. So what's your take on that documentary, considering that you have lived in Oregon for all those years?
My main reservation about it was I felt it really gave Sheila a very large role in defining what was going on. I knew her very well. She was a trip. What was really interesting to me, I have a couple of clients down in Silicon Valley. They're in their early 40s, beautiful Indian couple, but very westernized. They took sannyas a couple of weeks ago, and we went to dinner. We went to a ball game with some other friends of ours the other day. These friends have a little dinner party every Friday evening, and twice at those dinner parties, I've had confrontations with people who had something really negative to say about Osho and our way of life. This is way before Wild Wild Country. So we don't get invited to those Friday night dinners anymore because of that kind of thing. And here these people had said, hey, we saw this Wild Wild Country and it really was wonderful and even-handed. And they wanted to know more about it. And these are the very people who were had quite a patronizing attitude previously about it. So it hit a lot of people. You know, I don't. And then I have a speaking circle I go to, and somebody stood up and talked about it and had no idea I was involved. So it had a very wide viewership. Surprised me. I think it's great. It's really, for some reason, it's kindled a lot of interest in Osho. Rather than, maybe it scared some people away, but it certainly kindled a lot of interest.
From your point of view, because you live those events, what was your emotional reaction seeing the way they portrayed the time? How does it feel like to look at now from the outside?
Well, there were so many dimensions of what was going on at the time. I mean, share a home program. This was crazy. But the thing is, you see, most of us, like, for example, I was driving my, you know, excavators or my front end loaders and I was doing my thing. Was not aware of anything other than the fact that my own personal disdain for Sheila and her, but I stayed out of her way. I mean, I didn't have anything to do with them. I did my work and had my friends and had my lovers, and that was my life there. Then when they left, everything shifted. Then it was like everything fell into this kind of crazy, chaotic space, and things started to happen very fast. The ladies left, and then the FBI came, and Osho was talking and defending us, and defending himself also. It was a very difficult time. Actually, my father had come out, and he was one of the first parents to trying to get parents to stay out there, and he stayed there for a while. And when everything started falling apart, it was just too much for him. It was sad. It was very sad because I just assumed my rest of my life would be, and I never imagined I would be away from that commune. When he left, it was a shock, the end of something, even though there were some people who thought, oh, we can carry on and carry on. No, we can't carry on. We were there for him. I was there for him.
Are you still in touch with Sanyasin in California? Is there any center anywhere where you can connect with Sanyasin?
Oh, that's why I'm here. I mean, my whole social world and all my clients, almost all my clients are Sanyasins. No, that's my world. I mean, I'm involved in other things, but we're very, very lucky. We have a huge Sangha here. Many, many different, many, very different gradations. I mean, some old ones, a lot of old ones, but there are some young ones. I think this Sunday we're going to a satsang with what we consider the younger people. And that's the people in their 40s and 50s. You go to satsang at the center here, and it's everybody's in their 70s. And, you know, it's beautiful, but I like to see the young people come into the picture also and learn to, you know, meet Osho, understand Osho. And also, people get a lot out of just being around sannyasins, because we are who we are. We're spontaneous. We're pretty juicy. We like to take risks. I mean, this is what he gave us. I mean, I've got a beautiful picture of him looking at me right now. And I listen to him. I mean, I listen to Osho almost every night when I go to sleep.
Beautiful. And is that a center in California near where you are, where people get together, meditate, listen to Osho?
Well, what they do here is they have satsangs every week at a different house, but there's a main house where they publish the magazine, the Viha Connection. They've been doing that forever. And it's also a book center. Yeah, and that's 15 minutes from here. And it's a very compact group of people. I mean, yeah, they're all over the place, and I love it.
Fantastic. That's a good reason to visit California then. You mentioned that many of your clients are sannyasins, so I'd like to take this opportunity to ask if you would like to share briefly what you do, because I might be a potential client of yours, you know. I don't know if you handle high profile people or someone like hardworking who has some little savings and would like to maximize that. So can you explain briefly what, in which way you help people financially?
Well, I just work with a limited power of attorney, meaning that I have control over the buying and selling of securities in these accounts. I have a minimum of $300,000. And I get paid a certain percentage of the assets that I manage. It's as simple as that.
Nice. Okay. Well, I definitely would recommend an Osho Lover and Sannyasin if anyone listening wants to maximize the savings or want to like to have a advice from a financial expert. Definitely get in touch with you. And do you have a website or Facebook page or anywhere where people can know more about you and get in touch with you?
My website is personalizedmoneymanagement.com. One word, personalizedmoneymanagement.com. Always available to talk. I mean, I probably have room for maybe one more client these days, at the most two. I'm working pretty hard, you know. I just took in a new client with six accounts, so that's, I'm busy. But I would love to talk to somebody if they want to chat about their financial situation. I'd be glad to do that.
And I'll link your website to the show note of the episode. We're heading towards the end of the show. I've got three final questions for you. The first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Well, it's going to disappoint you, I'm afraid, Swaram. I'd like to say I get up and I meditate and I om. No, the stock market here opens at 6:30 in the morning. So I'm usually up at 6:15 or so, 6:30. And the first 3 hours of the day, I'm working at my desk here on buying and selling securities for clients. And then I usually go and take a break around 10 and go to the gym for a couple hours. And then in the afternoons, I'm back at the desk working. And other than that, if you want to know my rest of my life, I do speaking circles, which is really lovely. I don't know if you're familiar with them. And I do Five Rhythms dance workshops. So that keeps me pretty busy.
So the second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
My favorite meditation is Vipassana, vanilla Vipassana. Watching my breath is my favorite meditation. It's my only real sitting meditation that I do, but I really try, unsuccessfully often, but I try throughout the day to really notice when my mind is taking me out of presence, and use just everything I do as a meditation. Just keep witnessing and keep witnessing, and then, you know, the ego comes in and gets to know, and then go back and witness and just watching. That's really the meditation.
The last question is, you live the Osho experiment. You are one of the pioneers in this movement of creating a new man, Zorba the Buddha. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2018?
He was my guide, and I feel as if he's taken me to a certain place. It's not a day that I wear a little mala around my neck all the time. He's always here for me. He's just always, it's presence. He's presence everywhere. And so am I, and so are you. But his presence is everywhere. You know, you are my legacy, is what he always used to say. And it's true. He really does. Somehow, something happened, and he just lives through us in such an incredible way. That's only all I can say. Just beautiful. Now, thank you, Osho. Thank you, Osho.
Well, thank you, Jaipal. Thank you so much for sharing your love for Osho. It's beautiful when you were talking about trying to be aware in your daily life. It sounds easy, but it's actually the most challenging part.
It's the most challenging. My God.
Some people say just do 5 minutes of mindfulness meditation. But the real challenge, what in my understanding Osho was trying to lead us to, is also to bring that awareness 24 hour, whatever we do, especially if you work and you're sitting at a desk and you need to look at numbers at a computer, or, you know, in my job, I have to sell and negotiate and do this and that and try to be aware. That's really not easy.
Well, you sound like you really have a clear head, Swaram. I've been very lucky, really, just purely lucky, being in the right place at the right time to, you know, go back to New York with him, or go to Pune when he returned to Pune. It was just purely lucky being in the right place in the right time. I was blessed in this way.
And I'm blessed that I have a chance to connect with you and speak with you and capture your story. So thank you so much for your time, for talking to me and for sharing your love and experience and insight. And I wish you all the best, and I send you a lovely hug from Singapore all the way to San Francisco. Thank you. Bye-bye. All the best. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Lavo Show podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit lavoshow.com for new episodes, blogs, and much more.